Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Dark Tower, 5, Wolves of the Kala, by Stephen King. Read by George Guidel, with an afterword by Stephen King.
The Final Argument. Wolves of the Kala is the fifth volume of a longer tale inspired by Robert Browning's narrative poem, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came. The sixth, Song of Susanna, will be published in 2004. The seventh and last, The Dark Tower, will be published later that same year. The first volume, The Gunslinger, tells how Roland Deschain of Gilead pursues and at last catches Walter, the man in black, he who pretended friendship with Roland's father, but actually served the Crimson King in far-off Endworld. Catching the half-human Walter is for Roland a step on the way to the Dark Tower, where he hopes the quickening destruction of Midworld and the slow death of the beams may be halted or even reversed. The subtitle of this novel is Resumption. The Dark Tower is Roland's obsession, his grail, his only reason for living when we meet him. We learn of how Martin tried, when Roland was yet a boy, to see him sent west in disgrace, swept from the board of the great game. Roland, however, lays Martin's plans at nines, mostly due to his choice of weapon in his manhood test. Stephen Deschain, Roland's father, sends his son and two friends, Cuthbert Allgood and Alain Johns, to the seacoast barony of Magus, mostly to place the boy beyond Walter's reach. There, Roland meets and falls in love with Susan Delgado, who has fallen afoul of a witch. Rhea of the Coos is jealous of the girl's beauty and particularly dangerous because she has obtained one of the great glass balls known as the Bends of the Rainbow, or the Wizard's Glasses. There are 13 of these in all, the most powerful and dangerous being Black 13. Roland and his friends have many adventures in Magus, and although they escape with their lives and the pink Bend of the Rainbow, Susan Delgado, the lovely girl at the window, is burned at the stake. This tale is told in the fourth volume, Wizard and Glass. The subtitle of this novel is Regard. In the course of the Tales of the Tower, we discover that the gunslinger's world is related to our own in fundamental and terrible ways. The first of these links is revealed when Jake, a boy from the New York of 1977, meets Roland at a desert way station long years after the death of Susan Delgado. There are doors between Roland's world and our own, and one of them is death. Jake finds himself in this desert way station after being pushed into 43rd Street and run over by a car. The car's driver was a man named Enrico Balazar. The pusher was a criminal sociopath named Jack Mort, Walter's representative on the New York level of the Dark Tower. Before Jake and Roland reach Walter, Jake dies again, this time because the gunslinger, faced with an agonizing choice between this symbolic sun and the Dark Tower, chooses the tower. Jake's last words before plunging into the abyss are, "Go then, there are other worlds than these." The final confrontation between Roland and Walter occurs near the Western Sea. In a long night of palaver, the man in black tells Roland's future with a tarot deck of strange device. 3 cards: the prisoner, the Lady of Shadows, and death. "But not for you, gunslinger," are especially called to Roland's attention. The drawing of the 3, subtitled Renewal, begins on the shore of the Western Sea not long after Roland awakens from his confrontation with Walter. The exhausted gunslinger is attacked by a horde of carnivorous lobstrosities, and before he can escape, he has lost 2 fingers of his right hand and has been seriously infected. Roland resumes his trek along the shore of the Western Sea, although he is sick and possibly dying. On his walk, he encounters 3 doors standing freely on the beach. These open into New York at 3 different winds, From 1987, Roland draws Eddie Dean, a prisoner of heroin. From 1964, he draws Odetta Susanna Holmes, a woman who lost her legs when a sociopath named Jack Mort pushed her in front of a subway train. She is the Lady of Shadows, with a violent other hidden in her brain. This hidden woman, the violent and crafty Detta Walker, is determined to kill both Roland and Eddie when the gunslinger draws her into Midworld. Roland thinks that perhaps he has drawn three in just Eddie and Odetta, since Odetta is really two personalities. Yet when Odetta and Detta merge as one into Susanna, largely thanks to Eddie Dean's love and courage, the gunslinger knows it's not so. He knows something else as well. He is being tormented by thoughts of Jake, the boy who spoke of other worlds at the time of his death. The Wastelands, subtitled Redemption, begins with a paradox. To Roland, Jake seems both alive and dead. In the New York of the late 1970s, Jake Chambers is haunted by the same question, alive or dead, which is he? After killing a gigantic bear named either Mir, so called by the old people who went in fear of it, or Shardik, by the great old ones who built it, Roland, Eddie, and Susanna backtrack the beast and discover the path of the beam known as Shardik to Maturin, Bear to Turtle. There were once six of these beams running between the 12 portals which mark the edges of Midworld. At the point where the beams cross, at the center of Roland's world and all worlds, stands the Dark Tower, the nexus of all where and when. By now, Eddie and Susanna are no longer prisoners in Roland's world. In love and well on the way to becoming gunslingers themselves, they are full participants in the quest and follow Roland, the last Sepi-Sai, death seller, along the path of Shardik, the way of Maturin. In a speaking ring, not far from the portal of the bear, time is mended, paradox is ended, and the real third is drawn. Jake re-enters Midworld at the end of a perilous rite where all four, Jake, Eddie, Susanna, and Roland, remember the faces of their fathers and acquit themselves honorably. Not long after, the quartet becomes a quintet when Jake befriends a Billy Bumbler. Bumblers, which look like a combination of badger, raccoon, and dog, have a limited speaking ability. Jake names his new friend Oi. The way of the pilgrims leads them toward the city of Lud, where the degenerate survivors of two old factions carry on an endless conflict. Before reaching the city, in the little town of River Crossing, they meet a few ancient survivors of the old days. They recognize Roland as a fellow survivor of those days before the world moved on, and honor him and his companions. The old people also tell them of a monorail train which may still run from Lud and into the wastelands, along the path of the beam and toward the Dark Tower. Jake is frightened by this news, but not surprised. Before being drawn from New York, he obtained two books from a bookstore owned by a man with the thought-provoking name of Calvin Tower. One is a book of riddles with the answers torn out. The other, Charlie the Choo-Choo, is a children's story with dark echoes of Midworld. For one thing, the word char means death in the high speech Roland grew up speaking in Gilead. Aunt Talitha, the matriarch of River Crossing, gives Roland a silver cross to wear, and the travelers go their course. While crossing the dilapidated bridge which spans the River Send, Jake is abducted by a dying and very dangerous outlaw named Gasher. Gasher takes his young prisoner underground to the Tick-Tock Man, the last leader of the faction known as the Greys. While Roland and Oi go after Jake, Eddie and Susanna find the Cradle of Lud where Blaine the Mono awakes. Blaine is the last above-ground tool of a vast computer system that lies beneath Lud, and Blaine has only one remaining interest, riddles. It promises to take the travelers to the monorail's final stop if they can pose it a riddle it cannot solve. Otherwise, Blaine says, their trip will end in death. Charyu Tree. Roland rescues Jake, leaving the TikTok man for dead. Yet Andrew Quick is not dead. Half blind, hideously wounded about the face, he is rescued by a man who calls himself Richard Fannin. Fannin, however, also identifies himself as the ageless stranger, a demon of whom Roland has been warned. The pilgrims continue their journey from the dying city of Ludd, this time by monorail. The fact that the actual mind running the mono exists in computers, falling farther and farther behind them, will make no difference one way or the other when the pink bullet jumps the decaying tracks somewhere along the path of the beam at a speed in excess of 800 miles an hour. Their one chance of survival is to pose Blaine a riddle which the computer cannot answer. At the beginning of Wizard and Glass, Eddie does indeed pose such a riddle, destroying Blaine with a uniquely human weapon, illogic. The mono comes to a stop in a version of Topeka, Kansas, which has been emptied by a disease called superflu. As they recommence their journey along the path of the beam, now on an apocalyptic version of Interstate 70, they see disturbing signs. "All hail the Crimson King," advises one. "Watch for the walkin' dude," advises another. And, as alert listeners will know, the walkin' dude has a name very similar to Richard Fannin. After telling his friends the story of Susan Delgado, Roland and his friends come to a palace of green glass which has been constructed across I-70, a palace that bears a strong resemblance to the one Dorothy Gale sought in The Wizard of Oz. In the throne room of this great castle, they encounter not Oz the Great and Terrible, but the TikTok Man, the great city of Ludd's final refugee. With TikTok dead, the real wizard steps forward. It's Roland's ancient nemesis, Martin Broadcloak, known in some worlds as Randall Flagg, in others as Richard Fannin, in others as John Farson, the good man. Roland and his friends are unable to kill this apparition, who warns them one final time to give up their quest for the tower. "Only misfires against me, Roland, old fellow," he tells the gunslinger. But they are able to banish him. After a final trip into the wizard's glass and a final dreadful revelation that Roland of Gilead killed his own mother, mistaking her for the witch named Rhea, the wanderers find themselves once more in Midworld and once more on the path of the beam. They take up their quest again, and it is here that we will find them in Wolves of the Kala. This argument in no way summarizes the first four books of the Tower Cycle. If you have not listened to those books before commencing this one, I urge you to do so or to put this one aside. These books are but parts of a single long tale, and you would do better to listen to them from beginning to end rather than starting in the middle. Mister, we deal in lead. Steve McQueen in The Magnificent Seven. First come smiles, then lies. Last is gunfire. Roland Deschain of Gilead. The blood that flows through you flows through me. When I look in any mirror, it's your face that I see. Take my hand, lean on me. We're almost free, wandering boy. Rodney Crowell. Resistance. 19. Prologue. Runt. 1. Tien was blessed, though few farmers would have used such a word, with three patches. Riverfield, where his family had grown rice since time out of mind. Roadside Field, where Cod Jaffords had grown sharproot, pumpkin, and corn for those same long years and generations. And Son of a Bitch, a thankless tract which mostly grew rocks, blisters, and busted hopes. Tien wasn't the first Jaffords determined to make something of the 20 acres behind the home place. His grandpere, perfectly sane in most other respects, had been convinced there was gold there. Tien's ma had been equally positive it would grow porrin, a spice of great worth. Tien's particular insanity was Madrigal. Of course, Madrigal would grow in Son of a Bitch, must grow there. He'd gotten hold of 1,000 seeds, and a dear penny they had cost him, that were now hidden beneath the floorboards of his bedroom. All that remained before planting next year was to break ground in Son of a Bitch. This chore was easier spoken of than accomplished. Clan Jeffords was blessed with livestock, including 3 mules, but a man would be mad to try using a mule out in Son of a Bitch. The beast unlucky enough to draw such duty would likely be lying leg broke or stung to death by noon of the first day. One of Tien's uncles had almost met this latter fate some years before. He had come running back to the home place, screaming at the top of his lungs and pursued by huge, muty wasps with stingers the size of nails. They had found the nest. Well, Andy had found it. Andy wasn't bothered by wasps, no matter how big they were, and burned it with kerosene. But there might be others, and there were holes. You're bugger plenty of them, and you couldn't burn holes, could you? No. Son of a Bitch sat on what the old folks called loose ground. It was consequently possessed of almost as many holes as rocks, not to mention at least one cave that puffed out drafts of nasty, decay-smelling air. Who knew what buggarts and speakies might lurk down its dark throat? And the worst holes weren't out where a man or a mule could see them. Not at all, sir, never think so. The leg breakers were always concealed in innocent-seeming nestles of weeds and high grass. Your mule would step in, there would come a bitter crack like a snapping branch, and then the damn thing would be lying there on the ground, teeth bared, eyes rolling, braying its agony at the sky. Until you put it out of its misery, that was. And stock was valuable in Colubrin, Sturgis, even stock that wasn't precisely threaded. Tien therefore plowed with his sister in the traces. No reason not to. Tia was runt, hence good for little else. She was a big girl. The runt ones often grew to prodigious size, and she was willing, man, Jesus lover. The old fella had made her a Jesus tree, what he called a crucifix, and she wore it everywhere. It swung back and forth now, thumping against her sweating skin as she pulled. The plow was attached to her shoulders by a rawhide harness. Behind her, alternately guiding the plow by its old ironwood handles and his sister by the hame traces, Tien grunted and yanked and pushed when the blade of the plow dropped down and verged on becoming stuck. It was the end of full earth, but as hot as midsummer here in Son of a Bitch. Tia's overalls were dark and damp and stuck to her long and meaty thighs. Each time Tien tossed his head to get his hair out of his eyes, sweat flew out of the mop in a spray. "Gee, you bitch!" he cried. "Yon rock's a plowbreaker. Are you blind?" Not blind. Not deaf, either. Just runt. She heaved to the left and hard. Behind her, Tien stumbled forward with a neck-snapping jerk and barked his shin on another rock, one he hadn't seen, and the plow had, for a wonder, missed. As he felt the first warm trickles of blood running down to his ankle, he wondered, and not for the first time, what madness it was that always got the Jeffordses out here. In his deepest heart, he had an idea that Madrigal would sow no more than the Porin had before it. Although you could grow devil grass, yar, he could have bloomed all 20 acres with that shit had he wanted. The trick was to keep it out, and it was always New Earth's first chore. The plow rocked to the right and then jerked forward, almost pulling his arms out of their sockets. "Ah," he cried, "go easy, girl, I can't grow him back if you pull him out, can I?" Tia turned her broad, sweaty, empty face up to a sky full of low-hanging clouds and honked laughter. Man, Jesus, but she even sounded like a donkey. Yet it was laughter, human laughter. Tien wondered, as he sometimes couldn't help doing, if that laughter meant anything. Did she understand some of what he was saying, or did she only respond to his tone of voice? Did any of the runt ones, "Good day, Si," said a loud and almost completely toneless voice from behind him. The owner of the voice ignored Tien's scream of surprise. "Pleasant days, and may they be long upon the earth. I am here from a goodish wander, and at your service. Tien whirled around, saw Andy standing there, all 7 feet of him, and was then almost jerked flat as his sister took another of her large, lurching steps forward. The plow's hame traces were pulled from his hands and flew around his throat with an audible snap. Tia, unaware of this potential disaster, took another sturdy step forward. When she did, Tien's wind was cut off. He gave a whooping, gagging gasp and clawed at the straps. All of this Andy watched with his usual large and meaningless smile. Tia jerked forward again, and Tien was pulled off his feet. He landed on a rock that dug savagely into the cleft of his buttocks, but at least he could breathe again. For the moment, anyway. Damned unlucky field. Always had been. Always would be. Tien snatched hold of the leather strap before it could pull tight around his throat again and yelled, "Hold, you bitch! Woe up if you don't want me to twist your great and useless tits right off the front of you!" Tia halted agreeably enough and looked back to see what was what. Her smile broadened. She lifted one heavily muscled arm, it glowed with sweat, and pointed. "Andy," she said, "Andy's come." "I ain't blind," Tien said, and got to his feet, rubbing his bottom. Was that part of him also bleeding? Good man, Jesus, he had an idea it was. "Good day, Si," Andy said to her, and tapped his metal throat 3 times with his 3 metal fingers. "Long days and pleasant nights." Although Tia had surely heard the standard response to this, and may you have twice the number, 1,000 times or more, all she could do was once more raise her broad idiot's face to the sky and honk her donkey laugh. Tien felt a surprising moment of pain, not in his arms or throat or outraged ass, but in his heart. He vaguely remembered her as a little girl, as pretty and quick as a dragonfly, as smart as ever you could wish. Then... But before he could finish the thought, a premonition came. He felt a sinking in his heart. "The news would come while I'm out here," he thought. "Out in this godforsaken patch where nothing is well and all luck is bad. It was time, wasn't it? Over time." "Andy," he said. "Yes," Andy said, smiling. "Andy, your friend, back from a goodish wander and at your service. Would you like your horoscope, Si Tien? It is full earth. The moon is red, what is called the huntress moon in mid-world, that was. A friend will call. Business affairs prosper. You will have 2 ideas, one good and one bad." "The bad one was coming out here to turn this field," Tien said. "Never mind my goddamn horoscope, Andy. Why are you here?" Andy's smile probably could not become troubled. He was a robot, after all, the last one in Calabrine Sturgis or for miles and wheels around. But to Tien, it seemed to grow troubled just the same. The robot looked like a young child's stick figure of an adult, impossibly tall and impossibly thin. His legs and arms were silvery. His head was a stainless steel barrel with electric eyes. His body, no more than a cylinder, was gold. Stamped in the middle, what would have been a man's chest, was this legend: North Central Positronics Limited, in association with Lamerck Industries, presents Andy. Design, messenger, many other functions. Serial number DNF-34821-V-63. Why or how this silly thing had survived, when all the rest of the robots were gone, gone for generations, Tien neither knew nor cared. You were apt to see him anywhere in the Kala. He would not venture beyond its borders, striding on his impossibly thin silver legs, looking everywhere, occasionally clicking to himself as he stored, or perhaps purged, who knew, information. He sang songs, passed on gossip and rumor from one end of town to the other. A tireless walker was Andy, the messenger robot, and seemed to enjoy the giving of horoscopes above all things, although there was general agreement in the village that they meant little. He had one other function, however, and that meant much. "Why are you here, you bag of bolts and beams? Answer me. Is it the wolves? Are they coming from Thunderclap?" Tien stood there looking up into Andy's stupid, smiling metal face, the sweat growing cold on his skin, praying with all his might that the foolish thing would say no, then offer to tell his horoscope again, or perhaps to sing the Green Corn Adeo, all 20 or 30 verses. But all Andy said, still smiling, was, "Yes, Si." "Christ and the man Jesus," Tian said. He'd gotten an idea from the old fella that those were two names for the same thing, but had never bothered pursuing the question. "How long?"
"One moon of days before they arrive," Andy replied, still smiling.
"From full to full?"
"Close enough, Si."
30 days, then, give or take one. 30 days to the wolves. And there was no sense hoping Andy was wrong. No one kenned how the robot could know they were coming out of Thunderclap so far in advance of their arrival, but he did know. And he was never wrong. "Fuck you for your bad news," Tian cried, and was furious at the waver he heard in his own voice. "What use are you?"
"I'm sorry that the news is bad," Andy said.
His guts clicked audibly, his eyes flashed a brighter blue, and he took a step backward.
"Would you not like me to tell your horoscope? This is the end of full Earth, a time particularly propitious for finishing old business and meeting new people."
"And fuck your false prophecy, too," Tian bent, picked up a clod of earth and threw it at the robot. A pebble buried in the clod clanged off Andy's metal hide. Tia gasped, then began to cry. Andy backed off another step, his shadow trailing out long in son-of-a-bitch field. But his hateful, stupid smile remained.
"What about a song? I have learned an amusing one from the Mani, far north of town. It is called In Time of Loss, Make God Your Boss."
From somewhere deep in Andy's guts came the wavering honk of a pitch pipe, followed by a ripple of piano keys.
"It goes..."
Sweat rolling down his cheeks and sticking his itchy balls to his thighs. The stink smell of his own foolish obsession, Tia blatting her stupid face at the sky, and this idiotic bad news-bearing robot getting ready to sing him some sort of manny hymn. "Be quiet, Andy." He spoke reasonably enough, but through clamped teeth.
"Si," the robot agreed, then fell mercifully silent.
Tian went to his bawling sister, put his arm around her, smelled the large, but not entirely unpleasant, smell of her. No obsession there, just the smell of work and obedience. He sighed, then began to stroke her trembling arm. "Quit it, you great bawling cunt," he said. The words might have been ugly, but the tone was kind in the extreme, and it was tone she responded to. She began to quiet. Her brother stood with the flare of her hip pushing into him just below his ribcage. She was a full foot taller, and any passing stranger would likely have stopped to look at them, amazed by the similarity of face and the great dissimilarity of size. The resemblance, at least, was honestly come by. They were twins. He soothed his sister with a mixture of endearments and profanities. In the years since she had come back ruined from the East, the two modes of expression were much the same to Tian Jeffords. And at last she ceased her weeping. And when a Rusty flew across the sky, doing loops and giving out the usual series of ugly blats, she pointed and laughed. A feeling was rising in Tian, one so foreign to his nature that he didn't even recognize it. "Isn't right," he said. "No, sir. By the man Jesus and all the gods that be, it isn't." He looked to the east, where the hills rolled away into a rising, membranous darkness that might have been clouds but wasn't. It was the edge of Thunderclap. "Isn't right what they do to us."
"Sure you wouldn't like to hear your horoscope, Si. I see bright coins and a beautiful dark lady."
"The dark ladies will have to do without me," Tian said, and began pulling the harness off his sister's broad shoulders. "I'm married, as I'm sure you very well know."
"Many a married man has had his jilly," Andy observed.
To Tian, he sounded almost smug.
"Not those who love their wives."
Tian shouldered the harness. He'd made it himself, there being a marked shortage of tack for human beings in most livery barns, and turned toward the home place.
"And not farmers, in any case. Show me a farmer who can afford a jilly, and I'll kiss your shiny ass."
"Gone, Tia. Lift him up and put him down."
Home place? She asked. That's right. Lunch at home place? She looked at him in a muddled, hopeful way. Taters? A pause. Gravy? Sure, Tian said. Why the hell not? Tia let out a whoop and began running toward the house. There was something almost awe-inspiring about her when she ran. As their father had once observed, not long before the fall that carried him off, bright or dim, that's a lot of meat in motion. Tian walked slowly after her, head down, watching for the holes which his sister seemed to avoid without even looking, as if some deep part of her had mapped the location of each one. That strange new feeling kept growing and growing. He knew about anger. Any farmer who'd ever lost cows to the milk sick or watched a summer hailstorm beat his corn flat knew plenty about that. But this was deeper. This was rage, and it was a new thing. He walked slowly, head down, fists clenched. He wasn't aware of Andy following along behind him until the robot said,
"There's other news, Sai. Northwest of town, along the path of the beam, strangers from outworld."
"Bugger the beam. Bugger the strangers and bugger your good self," Tian said. "Let me be, Andy." Andy stood where he was for a moment, surrounded by the rocks and weeds and useless knobs of Son-of-a-Bitch, that thankless tract of Jafford's land. Relays inside him clicked, his eyes flashed, and he decided to go and talk to the old fella. The old fella never told him to bugger his good self. The old fella was always willing to hear his horoscope. And he was always interested in strangers. And he started toward town and Our Lady of Serenity. 2. Zalia Jaffords didn't see her husband and sister-in-law come back from Son-of-a-Bitch, didn't hear Tia plunging her head repeatedly into the rain barrel outside the barn and then blowing moisture off her lips like a horse. Zalia was on the south side of the house, hanging out Wash and keeping an eye on the children. She wasn't aware that Tian was back until she saw him looking out the kitchen window at her. She was surprised to see him there at all, and much more than surprised by the look of him. His face was ashy pale, except for two bright blots of color high up on his cheeks, and a third glaring in the center of his forehead like a brand. She dropped the few pins she was still holding back into her clothes basket and started for the house.
"We're going, Ma," Hedden called. And, "We're going, Mama," Hedda echoed.
"Never mind," she said. "Just keep an eye on your cobabbies."
"Why?"
Hedda whined. She had that whine down to a science. One of these days she would draw it out a little too long and her mother would clout her right down dead.
"Because you're the oldest," she said.
"But shut your mouth, Hedda Jaffords."
"We'll watch him, Ma," Hedden said.
Always agreeable was her Hedden. Probably not quite so bright as his sister, but bright wasn't everything. Far from it.
"Want us to finish hanging the wash?"
"Hedden?"
from his sister. That irritating whine again, but Zalia had no time for them. She just took one glance at the others, Lyman and Leah, who were 5, and Aaron, who was 2. Aaron sat naked in the dirt, happily chunking 2 stones together. He was the rare singleton, and how the women of the village envied her on account of him. Because Aaron would always be safe. The others, however, Hedden and Hedda, Lyman and Leah. She suddenly understood what it might mean, him back at the house in the middle of the day like this. She prayed to the gods it wasn't so, but when she came into the kitchen and saw the way he was looking out at the kiddies, she became almost sure it was.
"Tell me it isn't the wolves," she said in a dry and frantic voice. "Say it ain't."
"'Tis," Tian replied. 30 days, Andy says. Moon to moon. And on that Andy's never—" Before he could go on, Zalia Jaffords clapped her hands to her temples and shrieked. In the side yard, Hedda jumped up. In another moment, she would have been running for the house, but Hedden held her back.
"They won't take any as young as Lyman and Leah, will they?" she asked him. "Hedda or Hedden, maybe, but surely not my little ones. Why, they won't see their 6 for another 30 years.
"The wolves have taken him as young as 3, and you know it," Tian said. His hands opened and closed,
opened and closed. That feeling inside him continued to grow, the feeling that was deeper than mere anger.
She looked at him, tears spilling down her face.
"Mayhap, it's time to say no,"
Tien spoke in a voice he hardly recognized as his own.
"How can we?"
she whispered. "How in the name of the gods can we?"
"Dunno," he said, "but come here, woman, I beg you."
She came, throwing one last glance over her shoulder at the five children in the backyard, as if to make sure they were still all there, that no wolves had taken them yet, and then crossed the living room. Grandpère sat in his corner chair by the dead fire, head bent over, dozing and drizzling from his folded, toothless mouth. From this room, the barn was visible. Tien drew his wife to the window and pointed.
"There," he said. "Do you mark him, woman? Do you see him very well?"
Of course she did. Tien's sister, 6.5 feet tall, now standing with the straps of her overalls lowered and her big breasts sparkling with water as she splashed them from the rain barrel. Standing in the barn doorway was Zalman, Zelia's very own brother. Almost 7 feet tall was he, big as Lord Perth, tall as Andy, and as empty a face as the girl. A strapping young man watching a strapping young woman with her breasts out on show like that might well have been sporting a bulge in his pants. But there was none in Zally's. No, ever would be. He was ruined. She turned back to Tien. They looked at each other. A man and a woman not ruined, but only because of dumb luck. So far as either of them knew, it could just as easily have been Zal and Tia standing in here and watching Tien and Zelia out by the barn, grown large of body and empty of head.
"Of course I see," she told him.
"Does thee think I'm blind?" "Don't it sometimes make you wish you was?" he asked. "To see him so?"
Zelia made no reply.
"Not right, woman. Not right. Never has been."
"But since time out of mind—"
"Bugger time out of mind, too," Tien cried. "There's children. Our children."
"Would you have the wolves burn the collar to the ground, then? Leave us all with our throats cut and our eyes fried in our heads? For it's happened before. You know it has."
He knew, all right. But who would put matters right if not the men of Calla Bryn Sturgis? Certainly there were no authorities, not so much as a sheriff, either high or low in these parts. They were on their own. Even long ago, when the inner baronies had glowed with light and order, they would have seen precious little sign of that bright life out here. These were the borderlands, and life here had always been strange. Then the wolves had begun coming, and life had grown far stranger. How long ago had it begun? How many generations? Tien didn't know, but he thought time out of mind was too long. The wolves had been raiding into the borderland villages when Grandpère was young. Certainly, Grandpère's own twin had been snatched as the two of them sat in the dust playing at jacks.
"They took him 'cause he closer to the road,"
Grandpère had told them many times.
"If I come out of your house first that day, I be closer to the road and they take me. God is good."
Then he would kiss the wooden cruci the old fellow had given him, hold it skyward, and cackle.
Yet Grandpère's own grandpère had told him that in his day, which would have been 5 or perhaps even 6 generations back, if Tien's calculations were right, there had been no wolves sweeping out of Thunderclap on their gray horses. Once Tien had asked the old man, "And did all but a few of the babbies come in twos back then? Did any of the old folks ever say?" Grandpère had considered this long, then had shaken his head. No, he couldn't remember what the old-timers had ever said about that, one way or the other. Zelia was looking at him anxiously.
"You're in no mood to think of such things, I wot, after spending your morning in that rocky patch."
"My frame of mind won't change when they come, or who they'll take," Tien said.
"You'll not do something foolish, T, will you? Something foolish and all on your own?"
"No,"
he said. No hesitation. He's already begun to lay plans, she thought, and allowed herself a thin gleam of hope. Surely there was nothing Tien could do against the wolves, nothing any of them could do, but he was far from stupid.
In a farming village where most men could think no further than planting the next row or planting their stiffies on Saturday night, Tien was something of an anomaly. He could write his name. He could write words that said, "I love you, Zaylee," and had won her by so doing, even though she couldn't read them there in the dirt. He could add the numbers and also call them back from big to small, which he said was even more difficult. Was it possible? Part of her didn't want to complete that thought. And yet, when she turned her mother's heart and mind to Hedda and Hedden, Leah and Lyman, part of her wanted to hope. What then? "I'm going to call a town gathering. I'll send the feather. Will they come? When they hear this news, every man in the Kala will turn up. We'll talk it over. Mayhap they'll want to fight this time. Mayhap they'll want to fight for their babbies." From behind them, a cracked old voice said, "You foolish killin'." Tien and Zaylee turned, hand in hand, to look at the old man. Killin' was a harsh word, but Tien judged the old man was looking at them, at him, kindly enough. "Why do you say so, Grandpère?" he asked. "Men would go forward from such a meeting as you plan on, and burn down half the countryside where they and drink," the old man said. "Men sober?" He shook his head. "You'll never move such." "I think this time you might be wrong, Grandpère," Tien said, and Zaylee felt cold terror squeeze her heart. And yet, buried in it, warm, was that hope. 3. There would have been less grumbling if he'd given them at least one night's notice, but Tien wouldn't do that. They didn't have the luxury of even a single fallow night, and when he sent Hedden and Hedda with the feather, they did come. He'd known they would.
The Kala's gathering hall stood at the end of the village high street, beyond Took's general store and catter-corner from the town pavilion, which was now dusty and dark with the end of summer. Soon enough, the ladies of the town would begin decorating it for reap. But they'd never made a lot of reaping night in the Kala. The children always enjoyed seeing the stuffy guys thrown on the fire, of course, and the bolder fellows would steal their share of kisses as the night itself approached, but that was about it. Your fripperies and festivals might do for mid-world and in-world, but this was neither. Out here they had more serious things to worry about than reaping day fairs. Things like the wolves. Some of the men, from the well-to-do farms to the west and the three ranches to the south, came on horses. Eisenhart of the Rocking Bee even brought his rifle and wore criss-crossed ammunition bandoliers. Tien Jaffords doubted if the bullets were any good, or that the ancient rifle would fire even if some of them were. A delegation of the Manny folk came crammed into a bucca drawn by a pair of muti geldings, one with three eyes, the other with a pylon of raw pink flesh poking out of its back. Most of the Kala men came on donks and burros, dressed in their white pants and long, colorful shirts. They knocked their dusty sombreros back on the tug strings with calloused thumbs as they stepped into the gathering hall, looking uneasily at each other. The benches were of plain pine. With no womenfolk and none of the root ones, the men filled fewer than 30 of the 90 benches. There was some talk, but no laughter at all.
Tien stood out front with the feather now in his hands, watching the sun as it sank toward the horizon, its gold steadily deepening to a color that was like infected blood. When it touched the land, he took one more look up the high street. It was empty except for three or four runt fellows sitting on the steps of Took's. All of them huge and good for nothing more than yanking rocks out of the ground. He saw no more men, no more approaching donkeys. He took a deep breath, let it out, then drew in another and looked up at the deepening sky. "Man Jesus, I don't believe in you," he said. "But if you're there, help me now. Tell God thank you." Then he went inside and closed the gathering hall doors a little harder than was strictly necessary. The talk stopped. 140 men, most of them farmers, watched him walk to the front of the hall, the wide legs of his white pants swishing, his shore boots clacking on the hardwood floor. He had expected to be terrified by this point, perhaps even to find himself speechless.
He was a farmer, not a stage performer or a politician. Then he thought of his children, and when he looked up at the men, he found he had no trouble meeting their eyes. The feather in his hands did not tremble. When he spoke, his words followed each other easily, naturally, and coherently. They might not do as he hoped they would, Grandpère could be right about that, but they looked willing enough to listen. "You all know who I am," he said as he stood there with his hands clasped around the reddish feather's ancient stalk. "Tian Jaffords, son of Luke, husband of Zelia Hunik, that was. She and I have 5, 2 pairs and a singleton." Low murmurs at that, most probably having to do with how lucky Tian and Zelia were to have their Aaron. Tian waited for the voices to die away.
"I've lived in the Kala all my life. I've shared your kef and you have shared mine. Now hear what I say, I beg."
"We say thank you, Sai," they murmured. It was little more than a stock response, yet Tian was encouraged. "The wolves are coming," he said. "I have this news from Andy. 30 days from moon to moon, and then they're here." More low murmurs. Tian heard dismay and outrage, but no surprise. When it came to spreading news, Andy was extremely efficient. "Even those of us who can read and write a little have almost no paper to write on," Tian said, "so I cannot tell you with any real certainty when last they came. There are no records, you can, just one mouth to another. I know I was well breached, so it's longer than 20 years. "It's 24, said a voice in the back of the room. "Nay, 23, said a voice closer to the front. Reuben Cavera stood up. He was a plump man with a round, cheerful face. The cheer was gone from it now, however, and it showed only distress. "They took Ruth, my sister. Hear me, I beg." A murmur, really no more than a vocalized sigh of agreement, came from the men sitting crammed together on the benches. They could have spread out, but had chosen shoulder to shoulder instead. Sometimes there was comfort in discomfort, Tian reckoned. Reuben said, "We were playing under the big pine in the front yard when they came. I made a mark on that tree each year after. Even after they brung her back, I went on with them. It's 23 marks in 23 years. With that, he sat down. 23 or 24 makes no difference, Tian said. "Those who were kiddies when the wolves came last time have grown up since and had kiddies of their own. There's a fine crop here for those bastards, a fine crop of children." He paused, giving them a chance to think of the next idea for themselves before speaking it aloud. "If we let it happen," he said at last, "if we let the wolves take our children into Thunderclap and then send them back to us ruined."
"What the hell else can we do?"
cried a man sitting on one of the middle benches. "They's not human." At this there was a general and miserable mumble of agreement. One of the men who stood up, pulling his dark blue cloak tight against his bony shoulders, he looked around at the others with baleful eyes. They weren't mad, those eyes, but to Tian, they looked a long league from reasonable. "Hear me, I beg," he said. "We say thank you, Sai," respectful but reserved. To see a Manny in town was a rare thing, and here were 8 all in a bunch. Tian was delighted they had come, if anything would underline the deadly seriousness of this business. The appearance of the Manny would do it. The gathering hall door opened, and one more man slipped inside. He wore a long black coat. There was a scar on his forehead. None of the men, including Tian, noticed. They were watching the Manny.
"Hear what the Book of Manny says. When the angel of death passed over Egypt, he killed the firstborn in every house where the blood of a sacrificial lamb hadn't been daubed on the doorposts. So says the book."
"Praise the book," said the rest of the Manny.
"Perhaps we should do likewise,"
the Manny spokesman went on. His voice was calm, but a pulse beat wildly in his forehead.
"Perhaps we should turn these next 30 days into a festival of joy for the wee ones, and then put them to sleep, and let their blood out upon the earth. Let the wolves take their corpses into the east, should they desire."
"You're insane," Benito Cash said, indignant and at the same time almost laughing.
"You and all your kind, we ain't gonna kill our babbies."
"Would the ones that come back not be better off dead?" the Manny responded. "Great useless hulks, scooped out shells." Aye. And what about their brothers and sisters? Asked Von Eisenhart. For the wolves only take one out of every two, as you very well know.
A second Manny rose, this one with a silky white beard flowing down over his breast. The first one sat down. The old man, Henchik, looked around at the others, then at Tien.
You hold the feather, young fella. May I speak?
Tien nodded for him to go ahead. This wasn't a bad start at all. Let them fully explore the box they were in, explore it all the way to the corners. He was confident they'd see there were only two alternatives in the end. Let the wolves take one of every pair under the age of puberty, as they always had, or stand and fight. But to see that, they needed to understand that all other ways out were dead ends. The old man spoke patiently, sorrowfully even.
"'Tis a terrible idea, aye. But think ye this, Sighs. If the wolves were to come and find us childless, they might leave us alone ever after.
Aye, so they might,
one of the smallhold farmers rumbled. His name was Borge Estrada.
And so they might not. Manny Sai, would you really kill a whole town's children for what might be?
A strong rumble of agreement ran through the crowd. Another smallholder, Garrett Strong, rose to his feet. His pug dog's face was truculent. His thumbs were hung in his belt.
Better we all kill ourselves, he said. Babbies and grown-ups alike.
The Manny didn't look outraged at this, nor did any of the other blue cloaks around him.
It's an option, the old man said. We would speak of it if others would.
He sat down.
Not me, Garrett Strong said. It'd be like cutting off your damn head to save shaving. Hear me, I beg.
There was laughter and a few cries of hear you very well. Garrett sat back down, looking a little less tense, and put his head together with Von Eisenhart. One of the other ranchers, Diego Adams, was listening in, his black eyes intent. Another smallholder rose, Bucky Javier. He had bright little blue eyes and a small head that seemed to slope back from his goateed chin.
What if we left for a while? He asked. What if we took our children and went back west? All the way to the west branch of the big river, mayhap.
There was a moment of considering silence at this bold idea. The west branch of the Hwai was almost all the way back to Midworld, where, according to Andy, a great palace of green glass had lately appeared and even more lately disappeared again. Tien was about to respond himself when Evan Took, the storekeeper, did it for him. Tien was relieved. He hoped to be silent as long as possible. When they were talked out, he'd tell them what was left.
Are you mad? Eben asked. Wolves had come in, see us gone, and burn all to the ground. Farms and ranches, crops and stores, root and branch. What would we come back to?
And what if they came after us?
Borge Estrada chimed in.
Do you think we'd be hard to follow for such as the wolves? They'd burn us out, as Took says, ride our back trail and take the kiddies anyway.
Louder agreement. The stomp of shore boots on the plain pine floorboards, and a few cries of, hear him, hear him.
Besides, Neil Faraday said, standing and holding his vast and filthy sombrero in front of him, they never steal all our children.
He spoke in a frightened, let's be reasonable tone that set Tien's teeth on edge. It was this council he feared above all others. Its deadly, false call to reason. One of the Manny, this one younger and beardless, uttered a sharp and contemptuous laugh.
Ah, one saved out of every two, and that make it all right, does it? God bless thee.
He might have said more, but Henchik clamped a gnarled hand on the young man's arm. The young one said no more, but he didn't lower his head submissively either. His eyes were hot, his lips a thin white line.
I don't mean it's right, Neil said.
He had begun to spin his sombrero in a way that made Tien feel a little dizzy.
But we have to face the realities, don't we? Aye, and they don't take them all. Why, my daughter Georgina, she's just as apt and canny.
You are, and your son George is a great empty-headed galoot,
Ben Sleitman said. Sleitman was Eisenhart's foreman, and he did not suffer fools lightly. He took off his spectacles, wiped them with a bandana, and set them back on his face.
I seen him setting on the steps in front of Tookie's when I rode down street.
Seen him very well, him and some others equally empty-brained. But I know, Sleitman said, it's a hard decision. Some empty brains may be better than all dead. He paused. Or all taken instead of just half.
Cries of hear him and say thanky, as Ben Sleitman sat down.
They always leave us enough to go on with, don't they?
Asked a smallhold farmer whose place was just west of Tien's, near the edge of the Kala. His name was Lewis Haycox, and he spoke an amusing, bitter tone of voice. Below his mustache, his lips curved in a smile that didn't have much humor in it.
We won't kill our children, he said, looking at the money. All God's grace to you, gentlemen, but I don't believe even you could do so, came it right down to the killing floor. Or not all of you. We can't pull up bag and baggage and go west, or in any other direction, because we leave our farms behind. They'd burn us out, all right, and come after the children just the same. They need 'em, God's know why. It always comes back to the same thing. We're farmers, most of us. Strong when our hands are in the soil, weak when they ain't. I got two kiddies of my own, 4 years old. And I love 'em both well, should hate to lose either. But I'd give one to keep the other, and my farm.
Murmurs of agreement met this.
What other choice do we have? I say this, it would be the world's worst mistake to anger the wolves. Unless, of course, we can stand against them. If 'twere possible, I'd stand, but I just don't see how it is.
Tien felt his heart shrivel with each of Haycox's words. How much of his thunder had the man stolen? God's in the man, Jesus. Wayne Overholzer got to his feet.
He was Kala Bryn Sturgis's most successful farmer and had a vast, sloping belly to prove it.
Hear me, I beg.
We say thank you, Si, they murmured.
Tell you what we're going to do, he said, looking around. What we always done, that's what. Do any of you want to talk about standing against the wolves? Are any of you that mad? With what, spears and rocks? A few bows and bars? Maybe four rusty old soft calibers like that?
He jerked a thumb toward Eisenhart's rifle.
Don't be making fun of my shooting iron, son, Eisenhart said, but he was smiling ruefully.
They'll come and they'll take the children, Overholzer said, looking around. Some of 'em. Then they'll leave us alone again for a generation or even longer. So it is, so it has been, and I say leave it alone.
Disapproving rumbles rose at this, but Overholzer waited them out.
23 years or 24, it don't matter, he said when they were quiet again. Either way, it's a long time of peace. Could be you've forgotten a few things, folks. One is that children are like any other crop. God always sends more. I know that sounds hard, but it's how we've lived and how we have to go on.
Tien didn't wait for any of the stock responses. If they went any further down this road, any chance he might have to turn them would be lost. He raised the opopanax feather and said,
Hear what I say. Would you hear, I beg?
Thank you, Si, they responded.
Overholzer was looking at Tien distrustfully.
And you're right to look at me so, the farmer thought, for I've had enough of such cowardly common sense, so I have. Wayne Overholzer is a smart man and a successful man, Tien said, and I hate to speak against his position for those reasons, and for another as well. He's old enough to be my da.
Well, he ain't your da,
Garrett Strong's only farmhand, Rossiter, his name was, called out, and there was general laughter. Even Overholzer smiled at this jest.
Son, if you truly hate to speak again me, don't you do it, Overholzer said.
He continued to smile, but only with his mouth.
I must, though, Tien said.
He began to walk slowly back and forth in front of the benches. In his hands, the rusty red plume of the opopanax feather swayed. Tien raised his voice slightly so they'd understand he was no longer speaking just to the big farmer.
I must because Si Overholzer is old enough to be my da. His children are grown, do you ken it? And so far as I know, there were only two to begin with, one girl and one boy.
He paused, then shot the killer.
Born 2 years apart.
Both singletons, in other words. Both safe from the wolves, although he didn't need to say it right out loud. The crowd murmured. Overholzer flushed a bright and dangerous red.
That's a rotten goddamn thing to say. My get's got nothing to do with this, whether single or double. Give me that feather, Jeffords. I got a few more things to say.
But the boots began to thump down on the boards, slowly at first, then picking